The data showed it was pretty wild, but every time that athlete had a really high training load, it could have been from a really intense practice or let's say a double overtime game, they would recover almost fully the next day.
Welcome to the First Beat Sports Podcast, where we talk with coaches and sports scientists to explore the latest in how performance monitoring is making a difference in the NCAA and pro sports alike. We're going to connect you with practical advice from the best in the business to help you take your athletes to the next level. Today we're talking to our very own Benjamin Jensen, head of First Beat Sports USA, who is also the usual host of our podcast. A former coach, BJ has worked with elite sports programs for over 6 years through First Beat, and will be sharing some of the insights he's picked up along the way. So let's get started. All right, Ben. Well, good to see you today. You're normally in the host chair, but you've got your own background in sports too. Why don't you talk us through your career?
Yeah, good to be here. Thanks for having me on this podcast. It's definitely an interesting situation to be on the other side.
Well, you're always welcome on your own show.
That's true. That's very true. Good point. Yeah, so I started to coach American football over here in Finland back in 2004. I started with the junior program here, which is kind of the equivalent of basically high school in the U.S. I worked with the junior program for about 10 years. I started to also work with the Finnish junior national team in 2007. Worked my way up from special teams to head coach and was head coach for 4 years. Then 2010, I took over the professional football team here in Jyväskylä here in central Finland. Coached them for 4 seasons and then also started to work with the men's national team in 2012 and worked a couple seasons with them as well.
Hey, that sounds great. Maybe back up even before you were doing coaching. Tell me a little bit about your background as an athlete.
Yeah, so in high school, three-sport athlete. So I did American football, basketball, then soccer. When I went on to college, played soccer at junior college at Dixie College. And then I played a season at Utah State. When I came over here to Finland, randomly, because I was studying at the sports department or exercise science department, word got around that there was an American here who used to play American football, and the local team contacted me. They thought I was going to be something special, which, well, I don't know if I was or wasn't, but yeah, so I ended up playing 5 seasons here with the professional team. And I got to say, the biggest surprise to me was this, that when I started to play with them, I figured, okay, we're over here in Europe, right? They're going to have tons of kickers. Because, you know, back home, I did all the kicking and punting. And so I came over here and I did kicking for 5 years. They actually really needed me. We didn't have many that could kick the ball. So I was surprised at that. I guess the other thing I did in between was I was doing personal training for about 4 years before I came over here. Did do one bodybuilding show. I did one. That was more than enough for me. I enjoyed the experience, but I'll probably never do it again.
I know everybody's wondering, but maybe you can help us. Are kickers football players?
Kickers are football players. They are.
All right. Then you heard it there.
And another funny story was that at my high school, you know, when I was playing on the football team, coaches were always giving me a hard time for being a soccer player. You know, oh, hey, you play that sport where you run around and hit the ball with your head. So I took a lot of heat for that over there. And then, of course, now soccer wasn't as big as it is now. You know, this was back in 97. Then, of course, I come over to Finland, right? And everybody plays football here, soccer. And I start to play American football. So then my friends here are giving me heat. Why are you playing American football over here? You should play soccer. So I did it wrong both ways, but I wouldn't change it.
Have the Finns managed to strap a pair of hockey skates on you yet?
I played ice hockey once for the first time in my life when I was an exchange student. It was a good time, but yeah, that's definitely not my strength.
So it sounds like you've been busy. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what brought you to Finland in the first place and how'd you get started with First Beat?
So it's actually a little bit of a love story. So in 2003, I was an exchange student here in Jyväskylä. Sure enough, I met my future wife. Came back 2004 after I graduated from Utah State. Gave it a go for a little bit and things worked out. And so 15 years later and 4 kids later, we're still going strong.
What's it like living in Finland?
I can't complain. It's great. You know, they've got the great social system for healthcare and education. It's a really clean, safe country. So I definitely enjoy it here.
And how'd you get started with First Beat?
Completely by chance. So after I had finished up my master's and also finished up a teaching degree here, I was looking for an internship or something to keep me busy. I randomly found First Beat. So it was kind of funny because actually when I wanted to get the internship, I just took my CV and came directly to the company, walked straight into the CEO's office. Even he said this is highly irregular, but I knew I wanted to be a part of this company and spent 3 months on an internship and then did another 6 months kind of on a trial basis. They weren't actually hiring at the time, so I really had to prove myself and prove my value. Luckily, things worked out. Yeah, it's been a solid 6 years now going with First Beat.
Well, sometimes you just got to knock that door open.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't want to be just another email or phone message. So walking in there and bothering the CEO worked out pretty well.
Okay. And these days you spend a lot of time touring colleges and pro sports programs across North America. What are some of the big changes you've seen from day one, 6 years ago till now?
Definitely player safety, athlete safety is the hottest topic right now. Number one, keeping their players safe. And number two, you know, really in protecting those investments. When you've invested 20, 30, up to 100 million in these athletes, a lot of these teams are looking for, you know, any possible way that they can help prevent injury and keep those guys on the field so they don't have to lose that, you know, lose that investment for a game or for half a season.
How do you think that's impacting how teams are staffing the organizations? What's that mean at an employment level?
Yeah, you're definitely seeing a lot more of the sports scientist type roles. Sometimes it's a strength coach that kind of rolls over into that. A lot more you're seeing that they're hiring a lot of people, and a lot do come from outside the country. You know, Australia's been so big into the sports science scene that I work with a lot of Australians at a lot of different schools at, you know, NFL level or professional level, college level. So it's really just creating more jobs so that the strength coaches can focus more what they're doing conditioning and strength wise, and then letting the sports scientists just break down the data and give that feedback to the staff members and even the head coaches.
What do you see as sort of the most popular or the most effective talking points that the sports professionals are using with their athletes these days?
Definitely sleep, recovery, and training load is what everybody's trying to talk about. Training load, both internal, external, obviously. There's pluses and minuses for both of those, but, you know, I think the right combination of both can be extremely effective in helping to keep these teams on the field. I'll work with a lot of teams with return to play protocol. If there is an injury, how quickly can they get them back, and exactly when are they ready to come back? Instead of just saying, okay, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, doing the eye test, and obviously you're getting some subjective data on how do they feel. But, you know, when you have some load variables and you know what their numbers are, so you can bring them back at 30% of what a game would be and up to 50% to 70%. So you have just a really good mix of that objective and subjective data.
You mentioned load variables there. What are some of the metrics in particular that you find effective?
Probably the most popular metric is going to be our TRIMP metric. You know, we've spoken quite a bit about that in the previous podcast. I think the reason for that is it's a little bit more detailed, so to speak. You know, when we originally came up with this, it was a request from the NHL coaches. They liked the training effect on the scale of 0 to 5, but they wanted to see if there was something that could be a little bit more detailed. And so we came up with TRIMP, and we've modified it a couple times just to make it more effective and more accurate. Something that you get that TRIMP load for the day, and we've already calculated the TRIMP load for the week. And again, without doing any calculations, you're going to get your acute to chronic ratio for the last month on those TRIMP variables.
That acute to chronic workload ratio is something I know people are talking about, but you guys also added a TRIMP per minute metric in the past year or so. Can you tell me a little bit about specifically what decisions are being informed with that TRIMP per minute, what you see people using it for now, and maybe what you think it might grow into in the future as people get more familiar with it?
Yeah, the TRIMP per minute came just 100% from coaches' feedback. That's the one thing that I've loved about working with First Beat is actually I can listen to feedback and come talk to the people here at headquarters, and we can actually make something happen if it's a variable that's requested a lot. So we spoke to a lot of coaches, and everybody was exporting the data and calculating their own TRIMP per minute. So we said, hey, you know, let's get this in the dashboard. Let's get this on the real-time screen. Basically, what they've got now is they're using that as an intensity measure that, you know, if you've got a one-hour practice that's 100 TRIMP, you know, your TRIMP per minute is this, as opposed to 100 TRIMP for a two-hour practice. So you're able to see that intensity. You know, you can even do that between drills and for certain times of practice and games. So you can see what the intensity was. Is this drill actually mimicking the intensity of what you get in a game? And so that's definitely the most common metric right now that I think teams are using for intensity.
Okay, that sounds good. So one thing you might be uniquely positioned to talk about is differences in coaching practices and metric uses between Europe here, where you live, and the US, where most of your clients are working. What can you tell us about that?
Especially at the college level, obviously universities in the States, you know, that's a big business and there's a lot more money to go around. Whereas opposed to, you know, over here in Europe, everything is professional, semi-professional by the age of even 10 and 12, you know, at the university level. And the policy varies from university to university. Some coaches, they cannot see players wait. Even at the professional level, now you're starting to see that with players unions and stuff trying to protect the players, who owns the data, where can this data be used? Those types of things when you talk about contract negotiations and this and that, you know, there's kind of two sides of the story that I don't think the data should be used against a player for contract negotiations if they could show slower recovery, higher training loads. But I think in the big picture, when you have the data in the right hands to the sports scientists, to the medical teams, that's when they can actually assess, okay, maybe this guy, if we talk about basketball, for example, this guy might be actually a 25 a minute game as opposed to trying to play him 30 or 40, that he's going to be a lot more effective at this. Or even vice versa, he's only playing 15 minutes a game. He actually is recovering, doing well. He could do a lot more if he was needed. Football, again, is this guy a full-time defender, or is this guy a special teams type situation?
So far, we've talked a lot about kind of training load metrics and what they mean, how they're used. But on the other side of that, of course, you have recovery. And I think a very popular narrative these days is the ability to quantify recovery means that you're able to look and see who's recovering well, how you're able to improve recovery. But do you think that there are teams and players and sort of coaching assistants that are starting to recognize that recovery itself might be a form of skill, whether that's innate or something you can develop?
Definitely. And I think you'll see certain athletes, if you go at the high level, you know, what Tom Brady and some other guys have done to make sure that they can still play at this high level at the age of 40 plus, you know, with those football players and, you know, especially basketball players, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, nobody was really pushing 40. They were done. Now you're seeing guys that are still actually putting in quality minutes and quality time because of what they've done, you know, over a longer periods of time. Everybody always says, you know, just reducing minutes or this and that. It's really can be part of the equation, but what it really is, okay, how are they eating, sleeping? What have they done to their bodies for the last 5-10 seasons, you know, to actually be able to maintain and play at that higher level?
I mean, don't name any names, but have you seen individual athletes that exhibit stronger recovery tendencies than others, just sort of an innate ability to recover, something that you would describe like that?
Definitely. There is always a genetic factor to that. There's some people out there that are just so special that a typical workout or session that would really destroy a lot of athletes and make them sore for a couple of days, those guys can bounce back, you know, almost within 24 hours. So yeah, there's definitely been some athletes where I've just been amazed that I remember I looked at with one team, you know, it was their best athlete. The data showed it was pretty wild, but every time that athlete had a really high training load, it could have been from a really intense practice or let's say a double overtime game, they would recover almost fully the next day. So they always had their highest recovery actually after they had had a huge training load and just really pushed their body. And then their body just clicked into recovery and knew what it needed to do. So yeah, definitely it's an individual thing, the recovery aspect. It's been really interesting to see those.
It sounds like recovery monitoring is going to be a lot more important going forward as recovery strategies, recovery therapies sort of become more standard, but at the same time, more exotic. You see players using more extreme things like deprivation chambers, cryogenic stuff. So having ability to measure that, to see what's working, what isn't working, sounds like it's going to be an important part of the picture.
Definitely. Obviously, resources plays a huge, huge amount in kind of what recovery do you have? You know, these guys that can have, you know, masseuses on 3 to 4 times a week and the cryo chambers and this and that. But at the same time, you know, we've seen in certain situations, obviously what just came up in the NFL, you know, when things aren't done properly in the protocol, you know, I mean, getting frostbite from a cryo chamber and possibly missing games. Everybody's still learning a lot about this whole process. And you'll see published research kind of on both sides about cold water immersion and this and that for recovery. But yeah, I think it's definitely getting better. Excited to see where we go as we keep moving forward.
Sure. And what works for one guy or gal isn't necessarily going to work for everybody across the team.
Exactly. And it's been great to be able to work with HRV just because, you know, it's something that there's, you know, 10,000 publications. And, you know, since 2000, the amount of publications related to HRV and recovery, it's really blown up. Yeah, that's where I feel comfortable talking about recovery techniques that we have and this and that, just because there is so much science behind it. But definitely, you know, individual cases, even with HRV as well.
All right. Let's have some fun. We're going to ask Ben 10 quick questions and learn a little bit more about what makes the man tick.
Let's do it.
All right. Ben, who was your favorite athlete growing up?
Definitely got to be Michael Jordan.
All right. If you could play one sport professionally, what would it be?
Oh, that's tough. You know, I got to say NFL was definitely the dream, but, you know, my wall even now is plastered with Michael Jordan stuff. But definitely got to go with NFL on that one.
Fair enough. Cats or dogs?
Dogs, for sure. Unless you got the cat that has the special fur that doesn't make me sneeze.
All right. Favorite TV show?
Definitely got to go with South Park.
Oh, man, this isn't even fair. Finland or the USA?
Oh, that's brutal. Yeah, that's tough.
Not fair. Pass?
Well, no, I'll say I love them both. And luckily with this job, I still get to make it back to the States, you know, 60, 70 days a year. But I have to say this, when there is a hockey game, I'm rooting for the US versus Finland.
All right. Well, I guess our colleagues will let us walk out of here. what's your biggest fear?
Biggest fear? Oh, probably heights. I'll do some cliff jumping and stuff, but yeah, I'm just terrified when I'm up there, but I do enjoy getting it out of the way.
It's not a lack of good recovery?
If I was serious about my recovery, it might be a better state, but yeah, no, I don't have great recovery at the moment.
All right. Favorite first beat feature?
Definitely Trimp. I think Trimp is just the easiest way to go. I like it, and it's easy to translate.
All right. If you had a superpower, what would it be?
Oh, boy. Good question. I think it'd be pretty cool just to fly around.
Wouldn't be calculate Trimp on the go.
Trimp on the go. I'm going to leave that to our data analysis crew here. They can figure that one out.
Probably better. Favorite food? All of it, right?
All of it. All of it. I know it's funny and everybody's going to laugh, but whenever I get back home, the first place I go to is Taco Bell, and I'm blown away at how delicious it is. So they just got 2 Taco Bells here, so it's getting better. But yeah, I love Mexican food.
Right on. All right. Guilty music pleasure.
Oh, good question. Probably, you know, kind of a 90s hair band guy, so I don't mind the ballads, but when I'm trying to mellow out, probably Elevation Worship.
All right. So what would you say the general interest level is in the kind of data that First Beat and others are providing for coaches and the programs you're talking to?
You know, it's definitely just exploded, the whole sports science, sports tech industry over the last decade for sure. Heart rate was coming to the game, you know, even 30 years, 20 years ago. Now you see, especially, for example, I'd say soccer has kind of been ahead of the curve as far as getting the heart rate, the internal load data. They've done a great job with that for a long time. You're starting to see a real trend of those that do have the external load and GPS data. You know, they've had that for 5, 8, 10 years, and they've got a real good feel for it. Now they're kind of looking for what can they actually add to this. And obviously it comes right back to the internal load, heart rate, and recovery as well. And it's one of those situations where, you know, if me and you, we both go run, you know, let's say 5 miles and we have a similar amount of sprints, so our external load probably shows the same thing. But what it might not show is that you barely broken a sweat. I'm over there getting the oxygen tank. So it's that's where the internal load really comes in to be valuable.
So that's on the coach's side. What are you seeing on the athletes? Are they more interested than they used to be, about the same?
Definitely a lot more interest. You know, like at the university level, you'll see those that are studying any type of physiology or exercise science, they seem to be really keen on the data. And even those that kind of don't understand it that well, their numbers, they want to know what they mean. How can they improve, or are they improving? You know, the way I've seen it the most is because, you know, we do give the coaches control of the data and they have the option to share it with the players. And most programs that I see, they do share it with the players, and it's just been beneficial in both ways, that it's going to help to create those conversations about, you know, what does the data mean? How am I doing? And then, you know, even for coaches to approach and say, you know, hey, we have, you know, some concerns about this and that. How are you feeling? How are you doing? I think players are definitely a lot more open to the data.
Good. Well, one thing that makes the First Beat sports platform kind of special is like the variety and the range of different features and metrics that are available. What would you say is one of maybe the underutilized ones that maybe gets kind of lost in the shuffle that, I mean, maybe isn't the star, but people could start to use to improve their coaching?
Great question there. To be honest, I couldn't name like a single feature. The first three we talk about for people to use is the quick recovery test, the TRIMP, and training effect. I think kind of the next step with a lot of teams, they're doing the balancing act. Either this person needs to trim up a little bit, or most common is they're trying to maintain weight. So the energy expenditure that you can see in real time, and of course afterwards, gives those coaches the opportunity to help balance that out. That if a strength coach has somebody for a workout, he knows they just burned 500-600 calories. Okay, that means I need you to have this protein shake, you know, this combination of a shake or a bar or something else from the fueling stations. So they go get them to the fueling stations, get them the right amount of calories, so they're always at a zero balance when they leave. So they've done their job. They've done the strength and conditioning, made sure that they've maintained that calorie intake. And so, yeah, I think maybe that would be one. That's kind of one thing about the system, is it's pretty simple on the surface. But then, you know, if you really like the data, you know, we've got about 35 different variables that you can export and work with. And so, you know, you want to keep it easy on the surface, go ahead. But if you kind of like to get dirty with statistics, you got those variables to work with.
One of the big promises of training data, training load, recovery, et cetera, is or the possibility of personalization in training. Another way to take it, though, is maybe positionalization might be the word, where you're tailoring the training expectations by position in a team. What are some of the positional structures that you've seen teams succeed with?
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, you know, in certain situations, you want to personalize it as much as possible. But again, if you're dealing with a roster of 30, 50, you know, football, you're talking about 85 now. So a lot of teams will create those subgroups. So in real time, they're able to see, okay, what kind of training load do the DBs have? What kind of training load do the offensive linemen have, type of situation? Because obviously in the same practice, you could have, you know, your offensive line could be up there at a 200 TRIMP dying. Whereas, you know, DBs or linebackers or somebody, for example, if they're not covering ground, you know, they could be even half that or less. It's definitely something that they're able to see, you know, which groups are doing what. Even at the NCAA level, sometimes I'll see through the first few weeks, they'll do it by class, incoming freshman, and they'll have sophomore, junior, senior. And what they really like to see is just kind of that stress response that those incoming freshmen or even transfers have. Because what you have is a lot of kids are leaving home for the first time, you know, living with roommates for the first time, the stress of school, the stress of, you know, now I'm competing with 20 other Division I athletes for this spot. So we've usually seen, you know, pretty big spike with those freshmen. But what you obviously like to see is when they're able to drop down after a couple of weeks, if things go well, the stress response decreases, their training loads kind of match up with the others. You know, they really start to adjust to that program, both physical and mental parts of just being at a university program.
Something that's cool at the position that you're in is you get to travel around and see a lot of different teams working, see who's doing what, and data from a lot of different players in different programs. But thinking about a normal training, what position on the football field is normally putting up maybe the biggest training load numbers during a particular practice?
I'd say during American football, you might be surprised, but yeah, offensive line, they're putting up some pretty big numbers there, especially if it's kind of like one of the hurry up offenses, no huddle offenses that most people run anyways. You know, I don't want to say that some other people can take it down off, but you know, on every play, those O-linemen are engaged no matter what. If you're on the backside of the field and you're a skill guy and you can see it's a, you know, an outside play or something's going out of bounds, you know, you can already lay off a bit as opposed to in the trenches, you know, to battle every play. So I think O-line is probably the biggest I see. As far as the other football, the kind that's played with a soccer ball, definitely the midfielders you're going to see have the highest training loads, especially those that kind of just go all game. And again, a lot of it depends on who you're playing and your style of play, but also sometimes those outside wings that are making those really long runs will have pretty high training loads as well.
It's interesting to hear you say that about the offensive linemen, because sort of intuitively you'd think that wouldn't necessarily be very well captured by, say, an external workload, because they're not moving a whole lot necessarily on the field, not changing, not doing a lot of the wrong runs.
Like I said, the external load's great data, but you know, when you've got these DBs that have ran 10 miles in a practice and you know the O-line may have covered one or two, that's not really telling the story, because as we obviously know, let's say you've got an offensive guard and a defensive end. Okay, those guys just did a 7-second all-out battle and the heart rate response is huge. You know, they could be up to 190, even 200, or according to the external load data, obviously they didn't move much, they didn't cover much ground. So yeah, that's definitely where it's been really valuable. You know, I can't mention a lot of the programs we work with, but almost every single American football program we work with, the number one guys, the first guys they're going to belt up will always be the offensive line.
Sounds like a great case for making sure that you're looking at the internal and the external workload together. One thing the First Beat I know that has been working more on or working towards is integration with platforms that bring that internal workload and external workload together. What are some of the platforms that you've seen working, or tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're really open as far as trying to make sure, you know, everybody that wants access or needs access to our data can get it. So we know a lot of programs that are dealing with multiple data sources, whether it's weight room, class schedules, practice schedules, heart rate, even some GPS stuff, they get a single platform that it can all shoot into. So we came out with our API. We have a basic one. We also have a customizable one as well. So, you know, if you're running Connection, Kinduct, CoachMePlus, SmartaBase, you know, any of those guys, I probably left one or two out of there, but working with any of those programs, you're able just to get the data right away where you need it, just trying to simplify things. Again, that's been something we've been big on, is making sure everything we do is just practical, so we're not adding much workload to these strength and conditioning and coaches or the sports scientists.
Great. So what are some of the biggest lessons you've learned yourself from interactions with coaches over the last few years?
I think at the end of the day, honestly, it's still just about relationships. It goes both ways, but then it's also part of their job as well. As you see when these coaches interact with the players, those programs that do the best and have a really strong culture and just a positive atmosphere, it's because of the relationships that they have. And so, you know, just trying to maintain these relationships with people, making sure that they get what they need.
Listening to the last few episodes of your show, that's something I really noticed, is the successful guys out there are really quick to drop the names. Everybody's helped them along the way and keep those relationships moving forward.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something, you know, we don't have 50 million to market the product that we have. So we try to just do it on a relationship support, making sure everybody gets what they need. You know, a lot of these coaches, you know, you're going to work with them in multiple teams or in different aspects. They're going to get promoted or they're going to move to a different job. A lot of them are depending on even head coaches and that. So it's really just important to build those strong relationships so that they remember who you are, what happened, how things were, wherever they end up the next stop.
Yeah, man, just keep building those bridges.
Yep.
That's all the time we've got here for today. Thanks for your time, Ben.
Thanks for having me on my own show.
If you like this episode, you can subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. That helps us out. And of course, you can catch up on all episodes at firstbeat.com. Until next time. Thanks for listening to the First Beat Sports Podcast. For more information about us and our sports monitoring systems, give us a call at 435-363-9533. Or you can send us an email to sports@firstbeat.com. You can also visit us online at www.firstbeat.com. Thanks a lot for listening today, and don't forget to be with us on the next edition of the First Beat Sports Podcast.